Zephaniah by Fred Pierce. Very unusually, the record of Zephaniah's family is carried back four generations. The point of this must be found in the name Hizkiah or Hezekiah, which suggests that the prophet was of royal descent. His date is given as the reign of Josiah, but since he describes Jerusalem and Judah as full of corruption and idolatry, he must have written before the reforms of that king, that is between 630 and 621 BC. State of the people of God is degraded, the land is full of violence, the judges are corrupt, the prophets false, the priests are idolaters who break the law and defile the sanctuary of God. The worship of God is abandoned and many are now indifferent or openly skeptical of God's intervention on behalf of his servants. And the account strikingly resembles that of Israel 100 years earlier, or even that of Nineveh given by Nahum. Human corruption ever takes the same notorious paths from age to age, a striking testimony to the power of natural instincts and a standing warning to all subsequent generations. Zephaniah has a good deal to say, understandably in these circumstances, about judgment, first of Judah and Jerusalem. Upon them the day of the Lord shall be one of wrath, darkness, and distress. The language is very like that of Joel 150 years before. The land and the city are to be desolate, the people taken into captivity. What power could in Zephaniah's day be expected to carry out this work of judgment upon Judah? By 625 BC, the Assyrians had ceased to be a threat to Palestine, while the Babylonians had not yet appeared, nor indeed did they seem likely to do so. The date falls into the period of the domination of the Scythians, the barbarians who had crossed the Caucasus about 630 and are said to have reached Egypt by 626. They were known as ruthless marauders, and they could well have seemed an imminent threat to Judah. But in the event, it was the Chaldeans, whose advent was revealed to Habakkuk, who proved to be the instruments of the divine wrath. Judgment is next pronounced upon the nations who are named: Philistia, Ammon, Moab, Egypt, and Assyria. The sentence upon the last named being the remarkable one of utter desolation, delivered at a time when Nineveh was still a great name in the Middle East. The grand design of the Lord is revealed in Zephaniah as twofold. First, the preservation of a remnant and their regathering to Israel and Zion, where the Lord thy God was to be mighty in the midst of thee. He would save them with joy and love. The language is very expressive of the deep feeling of God for his people. Next, the subduing of the nations with a view to their conversion to a pure language, that they may all call upon the Lord with one consent. And this was a final result which Israel had not at first contemplated, but to which their prophets were now accustoming them. There is, however, no precise hint as to how this result is to be achieved, and no mention of a personal Messiah. But the assurance that Yahweh, the God of Israel, shall be known in the eyes of many nations, and that his faithful remnant shall be to him for a name and a praise in the earth. The prophecy falls into four parts: the coming day of the Lord, and then at chapter 2, verse 4, the judgment of the heathen nations. Chapter 3, verse 1, the sins of Judah. And finally, at the 8th verse of chapter 3, restoration and redemption. That Hizkiah was really Hezekiah, the king, is the only suggestion which explains why the descent of Zephaniah should be given with such detail. The circumstances revealed by his prophecy make it practically certain that it must have been uttered in the earlier years of Josiah, before the reforms. The language suggests that the judgment is to be a universal one. I will utterly consume all things from off the face of the ground. That's the Revised Version. The phrase recalls the flood, as do the particulars, man and beast, fowls and fishes, and the assertion, I will cut off man from the face of the ground. That is, man generally, the race of men. But, as in the flood, it was the race of the wicked which was cut off, here it will be the stumbling blocks with the wicked. And so in the parable of the wheat and the tares, it is declared that the Son of Man shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, that is, all stumbling blocks. The next three verses are directed especially to Judah, the charge being idolatry and abandonment of their God, and the hand of the Lord shall now be stretched out, as it was over the land of Egypt, to cut off the Baal worshippers and the Kemarim, or black-robed ones, evidently some kind of idolatrous priests. The addition of the phrase, with the priests, suggests that these latter were priests of the Lord, but were faithless to him. And the offering of incense to the host of heaven on altars erected upon the housetops was common. So was the divided worship of Yahweh, and at the same time of the idol called Malcolm, their king. No doubt the king was Baal. The Hebrews, to show their contempt for this Melech, took away from the word its vowels and replaced them by the vowels of the word Bosheth, shame or abomination. The Hebrew for the king here is Melech, and by replacing these vowels from Bosheth, they produce this word Molech. God's hatred of their divided worship is well expressed in Jeremiah. Will ye burn incense unto Baal, walk after other gods, and come and stand before me in this house? There was another class even. Those who were just indifferent to the question of religion and had not diligently sought the Lord, as it is clearly necessary to do. Three types of sinners are therefore found in this passage: the open idolaters, those of divided allegiance, and the irreligious and atheists. In verse 7 are blended a number of features found in other prophets. Habakkuk has hush before the Lord. Isaiah, Joel, and Obadiah all have nigh is the day of the Lord. Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel all have the idea of a sacrifice. The day of the Lord spoken of by Joel had already come and gone with the invasion and the defeat of Sennacherib, at least in its first application. But the expression is used by the prophets of any signal judgment by God, either upon the nations or upon his own people, and especially of the last such judgment, which should usher in the uninterrupted reign of Yahweh. The sacrifice prepared by the Lord is Judah and Jerusalem, as it was Bozrah in Isaiah 34. And the guests, or sanctified ones, are the nations set apart to carry out this judgment, in this case the Babylonians. The heathen called to punish Babylon were my sanctified ones, and that's Isaiah 13. And Jeremiah makes use of the same figure. I have sanctified against thee, that is against Judah, destroyers, a man and his weapons. It's Jeremiah 22. The punishment is to come upon the princes, the king's children, but with no mention of the king, who would at the time be the young Josiah. In fact, the Babylonian judgment came upon his sons. The foreign dress, that's the RV, which the Israelites were adopting, replaced the band of dark blue upon the fringes of their garments, which they were commanded to wear, that ye may remember the commandments of the Lord. Since the band was also found on the mitre of the high priest, its intention was to designate the whole nation as holy to the Lord. That the Israelites were now imitating the more ostentatious dress of the Gentile nations, that of Babylon was especially luxurious in scarlet and vermilion, it was a sign of their departure from God in spirit. For dress has always been an indication of the mind, and so it significantly remains to this day. Although the precise allusion in the expression, those that leap on the threshold, is unknown, it must be some idolatrous custom, connected probably with the fates of the god Dagon and the subsequent refusal of his worshippers to step upon the threshold. It is remarkable that the superstition that it is unlucky to step upon a threshold is still widely held. Violence and deceit were the marks even of the servants. How often these two are associated as the prime traits of corruption. The earth was corrupt and full of violence, and the Messiah shall redeem their soul from deceit and violence. Psalm 72. In the day of judgment, there shall be a great wailing in the city, from the fish gate, thought to have been in the north wall, from the second or lower part. The term is wrongly translated college in 2 Kings 22, verse 14. From the hills, probably Zion and Moriah, there would be the crashing of demolition. Maktesh, and the word means the pounding place, is Jerusalem itself, soon to suffer judgment. The merchant people are the people of Canaan, used here of the inhabitants of Jerusalem, because their deeds are like those of Canaan, for with their ill-gotten wealth, that is silver, they shall be cut off. And Jerusalem is to be searched with lamps, as devout Jews search their houses before the Passover to remove every trace of leaven, so no deed will remain concealed by the darkness. As wine allowed to settle on the lees becomes curdled or thickened, so are those who declare their disbelief that the Lord will ever do anything. These men are like the ungodly of all ages, who do their own pleasure and say to themselves, "Thou wilt not require it. The Lord shall not see, neither shall the God of Jacob require it." It was the challenge of the Lord to his own people that their idols cannot do good, neither can they do evil. These faithless Israelites were in fact treating him as no better and no worse than an idol. Therefore, utter desolation should come upon them with the destruction of their material possessions, their houses and vineyards in which they delighted. In language like Joel's, Zephaniah now, verse 14, returns to the subject of the day of the Lord, when the warrior shall cry out in despair because he is helpless to deliver himself. And verse 15 contains a number of linguistic features. Trouble and distress are words of similar sound. Wasteness and desolation are derived from the same root, and both pairs of words have been used before in Job 15, chapter 30, and chapter 38. Darkness and gloominess occur together in Joel 2, while clouds and thick darkness are used by Moses in describing the giving of the covenant. Zephaniah was clearly well acquainted with the earlier writings held as holy by Israel. And although the application must be to Judah and Jerusalem here, the language reminds us of the world of Genesis 1, the earth waste and desolate and the heaven dark, before the Lord commenced his work of creation. So, for the faithless majority in Judah, it is back from the light of the Lord they have rejected to the power of darkness they have preferred. Upon the walled cities and in the corner turrets an alarm shall be sounded. The inhabitants shall find no refuge in their wealth in which they have trusted, but shall stumble as the blind and shall be destroyed from off the land. Speedy riddance is Isaiah's consumption and Jeremiah's full end. Because they have sinned against the Lord in despising his holy name, for the honour of which he is jealous. The violence of this denunciation of Judah is hardly less than Nahum's upon heathen Nineveh. Chapter 2. The first three verses contain a last appeal to the people to consider their ways. Sift yourselves, yea, sift, as dry sticks are selected one by one for the fire. The idea is evidently one of self-examination. The nation is shameless. The expression is said to mean does not grow pale. That is, with shame or fear. Before the decree of judgment come to pass in the day of the Lord's anger, for as chaff a day passeth, that is, the days of grace yet remaining, quickly passing, the meek of the earth are urged to seek the Lord. Their meekness is rather a humility, not primarily towards man, but towards God, a bowing down before him. We think of Peter's, humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God. Like poor and afflicted, the term is of frequent use in the Psalms and prophets as the contrary of the wicked, proud, and evildoers. Their characteristic is that they have wrought his judgment. Another word of immense significance for the understanding of the Old Testament. The judgment was firstly the statute delivered by God for the government of his people. That is, keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments. Then the religious ordinance with the moral obligation attached. Here it comes to be a synonym for the way of the Lord. As in Jeremiah 5, they know not the way of the Lord and the judgment of their God. This way of the Lord is only found by those who seek righteousness, that is, who obey the righteous requirements of God. And this implies a recognition of sin, for the requirements are only necessary because of sin. They accept his offer of pardon and seek meekness, that is, they humble themselves before him by trembling at his word. Such faithful ones shall be hid in the day of wrath, an expression which must contain an allusion to Zephaniah's own name. The Lord hath hid. And to certain passages in the Psalms, in the time of trouble he shall hide me. How great is thy goodness which thou hast laid up same root. For them that fear thee, thou shalt hide them, thou shalt keep them secretly, same root. Even amidst the general corruption, a remnant of faithful ones existed, and here was the message of comfort and encouragement for them. Verse 4. The word "for" at the head of this section suggests the idea of warning to Israel as they consider the fate of the surrounding peoples. The overthrow of Philistia is predicted in Jeremiah 47 and Ezekiel 25, but like Amos, Zephaniah mentions only four cities, omitting Gath, which may have remained under Judah since the days of Uzziah and Hezekiah. The names of the cities suggest their doom. Aza, that's Gaza, which means strong, shall be Azuba, desolated. Ekron, deep-rooted, shall be Teker, uprooted. Ashdod, which means waster, shall be driven forth violently. And Chebel, the band of the seacoast, shall be Chebel, in another sense, that is an inheritance for Judah. See verse 7. The appearance of the name Cherethites between the Philistines sites of verse 4 and the land of the Philistines of verse 5 shows that they were part of that nation. They are thought to have come from Crete, and a detachment of them evidently joined David's army. Their name means cutters off. Philistia is to become desolate and the seacoast pasture lands for shepherds. And the cottages of verse 6 are really diggings, which may signify wells. The word coast is Chebel, a cord or line, hence a portion or inheritance measured by the line. The inheritance of the land of the Philistines is to fall to Judah, a thought found also in other prophets. Ashdod's doom was to come at noon, that is, suddenly, when least expected. But the restored remnant of Judah are to lie down like a flock in the evening, the time of rest after the exertions of the day, for Yahweh, their God, shall accomplish it for them. Verse 8. Moab and Ammon, blood relations of Israel through their descent from Lot, were long-standing enemies of Israel. They are here charged with reproach and reviling, that is, cutting speeches against my people. The reproach of these nations was in their contempt for the God of Israel, who allowed his people to be oppressed by foreigners and was therefore blasphemy, against which Yahweh reacts strongly. As I live, saith Yahweh of hosts, asserting by these words that he alone has life and has the host of heaven at his command, while all the gods of the nations are dumb idols, Moab and Ammon shall be like Sodom and Gomorrah, cities which had become the type of utter destruction. A particular example may here be chosen because Sodom and Gomorrah were close to the border of Moab and Ammon, who themselves descended from Lot, were rescued by the mercy of Yahweh from the fiery destruction of those cities, but they are to become the possession of the remnant and the residue of God's nation. Since Israel have never yet fully occupied the territory of Moab and Ammon, the prophecy manifestly still awaits its great fulfillment. And these nations shall be judged for their pride, for the time will come when Yahweh will destroy all the gods of the earth by famishing them. That is, by taking away the offerings upon which they have fed, the fat of their sacrifices, the wine of their drink offerings, so that all the nations shall worship the God of Israel, everyone from his place, that is, each in his own land. Verse 12, the Ethiopians, a section of the old oppressor Egypt, are put here for the whole nation because of the dominant part they had played in Egyptian politics. They are to be destroyed by the Lord's sword, that is, by Nebuchadnezzar, three times called the Lord's servant in Jeremiah, and by the Babylonian armies raised up by him for the task. After the destruction of Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar invaded Egypt, which remained desolate 40 years. The desolation of Assyria and Nineveh, however, was to be of a much more lasting character. Abandoned by men, the site was to be the haunt of animals. The cormorant is said to be the pelican, and the bittern, the hedgehog or porcupine. The palaces and temples would be desolate, their cedar-paneled walls exposed. The proud city of Nineveh, who used of herself a phrase ascribed to himself by the Lord, I am, and there is none beside me, perhaps thereby indicating that the ruler of Nineveh, like the Pharaoh of Egypt, considered himself a god, was to become an utter desolation, a refuge of wild animals, and a subject of contempt. But if Judah was disposed to rejoice at this judgment, she should have remembered that Isaiah and Micah had already declared that her captivity was to be to Babylon. Chapter 3. The charge against Jerusalem is rebellion. Filthy is really rebellious or defiant. Defilement by sin and cruelty. The same charges are here levelled against Judah as those by Hosea and Amos at Israel. Her people had not obeyed the voice of God, that is, through the law and the prophets, and when chastisement followed upon disobedience, they were resentful instead of submissive, and trusted in Egypt or Assyria instead of in their God. Jerusalem's evil is within herself, for the rulers and judges are like wild beasts. The prophets are boastful. Light suggests water boiling over, and unprincipled, and the priests pollute the temple and break the law by offering perverse interpretations of it, which in effect violate its spirit. But there is another in the midst of Jerusalem as well as the unrighteous princes, righteous Yahweh himself. Every morning, the traditional time for doing justice, God gave proof that he was a righteous ruler in their midst. He had cut off the nations for their iniquity. The Canaanites, for example, before Israel, expecting Israel to learn the lesson of his righteous judgment upon sin and so to receive instruction, that is, to profit by correction. But the unjust were unmoved at this evidence of the Lord's righteousness and set themselves the more determinedly to follow corrupt ways. God's purpose in chastising them had not been attained. There would now be no alternative to their utter destruction. Verse 8, the section opens with a call to wait upon the Lord, evidently addressed to the meek of the land, for there will come a day and the definiteness of this expression is to be noted, there will come a day when he will pour out his judgments upon all the nations of the earth, a sweeping declaration which has certainly not been fulfilled up to the present day. And the prophecy resembles those of the close of Joel or Zechariah, Ezekiel 38 and 39, and of Revelation. But the result of these judgments is to be striking. For then will I turn to the peoples a purified lip. As the world before the dispersion at Babel was of one lip, though rebellious in heart, so now their words will be cleansed. The fruit of the lips is the sacrifice of praise, Hebrews 13:15. And they will all serve the Lord with one shoulder, that is, steadfastly, like oxen pulling against a single yoke. Thus the chastisement of the nation leads to their conversion. At the same time is the restoration of God's people. The RV margin offers a more understandable rendering of verse 10. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia they shall bring mine offering, my suppliants, the daughter of my dispersed. In favour is the parallel prediction of Isaiah 66. The rivers of Ethiopia are probably chosen as the area farther south with which the Jews had any dealings. A fit representative, therefore, of the whole world beyond. The word offering, by contrast with the word sacrifice, suggests a bloodless gift. Verse 11, the day of the judgment of the nations is also to be that of Israel's purging, for those who exult in pride shall be purged out. As Ezekiel 20 describes, I'll purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgress against me. They shall not enter into the land of Israel. There shall be no more haughty in my holy mountain. They will be left over as a remnant, an afflicted and poor people, that is, those of submissive and obedient mind. And they shall take refuge in the name of the Lord, or, as Isaiah says, the Lord hath founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall trust in it. The old sins of lying and iniquity shall be removed, and the remnant shall lie down and feed like a flock, and none shall make them afraid. The very phrase used in Leviticus 26 as a promise, if ye walk in my statutes. Verse 14, the next four verses are a remarkable expression of the reconciliation which God intends for the regathered remnant of his people when they are purged. The verbs are in the prophetic perfect, the past tense, which looks upon their act as already accomplished. The remnant are bidden to rejoice utterly, for God has taken away their judgments, that is, the evils inflicted upon them by him in his righteous anger. In the midst of them is now their king, no less than the Lord himself. Fear and half-hearted service shall be banished from Jerusalem, for God is their Saviour who will rejoice to do them good. It is a thought found in other prophetic passages. As the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. The Lord delighteth in thee. And Moses had declared long before, the Lord thy God shall rejoice over thee for good, if they sought him. Rejoice is a strong term, implying full and exuberant joy. Very strikingly, God will also be silent in his love. In the Revised Version margin and RSV note, for rest in, implying that he will no longer remember the sins of his people. So he promised through Jeremiah, I will remember their sin no more. And Micah, God who pardoneth iniquity, pacify the transgressions of the remnant of his heritage. The verse concludes, he will exult over them with singing. Truly a striking declaration of God's real joy in the accomplishment of redemption among the remnant of those who respond. Verse 18 is obscure, but literally reads, them that sorrow for the solemn assembly I gather. Of, or from, of thee they are a burden, upon her is reproach. Jerusalem is addressed, and it is her exiles who sorrow for the solemn assembly because they cannot take part in the feasts of the Lord. Them God will gather. For they are of Zion, her true children. Meanwhile, there is a burden, the reproach of her foes. But at the time of restoration, God will undo those who have afflicted Zion. That is, he will deal with them by way of retribution. Instead of being dispersed like sheep, his people should be praised and famous in every country where they had formerly been dishonored. A fulfillment of the word spoken to them through Moses. The Lord hath avouched thee this day to be his peculiar people, that thou shouldest keep all his commandments, and to make thee high above all nations, in praise, and in name, and in honor. And then the verse concludes, most significantly, that thou mayest be an holy people unto the Lord thy God. The praise will arise from the fact that the Lord has acknowledged them as his people visibly before the nations. And the cause that they have become like God and ceased to be like men. Zephaniah's last words emphasize the time, at that time, even in the time that I gather you, when I turn back your captivities, it's plural, before your eyes. This regathering will be the last, the final one, before reconciliation with God, and it will be accomplished openly, even as was the deliverance at the Red Sea, when Israel were bidden to stand still and see the salvation of God. And as those Israelites who saw that deliverance were called upon to obey the Lord, because ye have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt. So the redeemed remnant of the future will have before their eyes a similar deliverance and will remain faithful forever. Concluding reflections. As in other prophets, the people of God are reminded that if his judgments were to be poured out upon the nations, as Judah expected, how much more upon them because of their privilege and their dishonoring of the name of Yahweh. The implication of chapter 3, verse 7 is very instructive, however, for the understanding of God as judge. I said, surely thou wilt fear me, thou wilt receive instruction, and so their dwelling should not be cut off. Howsoever, I punished them, but they rose early and corrupted all their doings. The judgments of God were therefore intended as instruction, not, of course, in the mere sense of information, but rather of correction. God chastised them in measure in order that he might not have to chastise them utterly. It was a correction that Israel would not receive, and in the end, their condition permitted of no remedy, and their dwelling place had to be cut off. The redemption of the residue of Israel will mean the submission of the nations generally to the God of Israel, but verse 9 adds, for then will I turn to the peoples a purified lip, that they may call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one consent. This is no longer mere subjection, but reconciliation. The purified lip speaks of the acceptable nature of their praise of Yahweh. Their calling upon him suggests a conscious and deliberate service rendered with one shoulder, with no desire to depart from him in search of other gods. We've met this aspect before. In Micah, for example, and it is noticeable that while the earlier of the prophets, for example, Joel and Obadiah, have little trace of it, it occupies a distinct place in the later ones. Israel, the privileged nation, were being educated to receive it. How slow and unwilling their reception of it was is shown by the attitude of the Jews in the days of the Apostle Paul. But it is easy to see why the Apostle saw evidence of the call of the Gentiles in the Old Testament prophets. Zephaniah too has his conception of the spiritual worship God required. Seek ye the Lord, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness, seek meekness, it may be. Ye shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. Chapter 2 and verse 3. And that's a verse which expresses all the spirit of the prophet. The acceptable of the earth are the humble ones, in contrast with the proud, corrupt, violent, and materialist-minded majority. And for they, in seeking to do the will of God, are not ashamed or afraid to seek meekness, trusting in his mercy that they will be hid as treasure in the day of his wrath. Their confidence is based on the conviction that the Lord thy God in the midst of thee is mighty. He will save, he will rejoice over thee with joy. He will rest in his love. He will joy over thee with singing. We have a note here rather like that of Hosea. God feels. He is not just the impassive spectator or mere manipulator of human puppets. Who can doubt that his love for the humble remnant is real and profound? And who can doubt that to be able to save them in harmony with his own righteousness is for him a matter of rejoicing or even of exaltation? And who can doubt that the same principles still apply for the benefit of those who seek meekness and wait before the God who is their salvation.